step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Earth 911's Sustainability in Your Ear. This is the podcast conversation with a changemaker working to accelerate the transition to a sustainable carbon neutral society. I'm your host, Mitch Ratcliffe. Good to have you back. Journalist Esha Chhabra has spent a decade exploring the world for examples of social ventures. Those are businesses that blend profitability with creating equitable human outcomes. For the New York Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and other publications. In her new book, Working to Restore, Harnessing the Power of Regenerative Business to Heal the World, she describes her journeys and the entrepreneurs and activists that she met in the United States, India, Africa, and the fjords of Scandinavia, amongst many other locations. She describes social and environmental innovations transforming coffee, shoemaking, healthcare, energy, and hospitality companies, among others, that are becoming familiar to Earth 911 readers. But for many, the reflective, environmentally responsible thinking in working to restore may be a revelation. Esha's story explores additional dimensions of two terms that dominate green business discussion, regenerative and restorative, weaving the environmental benefits with social impacts that can help low-income people access resources sustainably. She discusses the key role of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals in setting new social priorities and establishing how we measure the value that business creates in society. And her book will be published on March 21st. You can learn more about Esha and her work at eshachhabra.contently.com. That's eshachhabra.contently.com. No spaces, no dashes. Welcome to the show, Esha. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. Well, hey, congratulations on having your book come out. I want to start off by asking you about a concept that you use throughout it. You write in the introduction, the regenerative mindset centers around circles as a collective, be it in the farm, in a factory, or in a business. Tell us how the idea of a circle really encapsulates this broad change in values and ways of doing business that you describe in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of reporting and interacting with farmers in the last 5-6 years. And as you get to understand how agriculture was done, you know, eons ago now, it seems like, it was a circular method. It was, everything was really either sourced from the farm itself or nearby. If you look at biodynamic farming, that's like one of the tenets of it. And so if you take that analogy and you apply it to business as a whole, I mean, we are meant to operate in an ecosystem that is nourishing itself and replenishing itself constantly. And so I think circular economy is very much so relevant beyond, you know, just the circular mindset in agriculture. And that's kind of at the core of the conversation we're having with sustainability, because yes, you can, you know, make products that are out of recycled materials, but then at the end of the day, if there's no plan as to how you're going to either properly dispose of that material or possibly use it again, you know, are you really doing a service? And there's also this whole discussion that's going on now as to how many times can you recycle certain materials? I mean, they do degrade with each time that you recycle them. And so this concept of how close can we get to a circle? I don't know if we can get to a perfect circle in every industry. But I certainly think that that should be the attempt. For too long, I've seen companies come up with products with really no end game in life. And yep. Finally, that's now changing, where the companies are thinking about the proper disposal or recycling of these products. And so I think that's a welcome shift. And sustainability also means, broadly speaking, regarding the book, sustainability has, I don't know if it's been thought about in a circular mindset from the get-go. I think that's more of a recent development as people mm-hmm. are, you know, battling with these kind of issues and topics. So that's why the regenerative mindset or the restorative mindset makes more sense, because it's less linear. You know, regenerating, you're regenerating something. You're giving it life again. Whereas if you're sustaining something, you're more or less sustaining the status quo, which is certainly not as circular in my mind.
Well, one of the things that's striking about a lot of the people you talk about is that they embrace the externalities that most people, most traditional capitalists, let's put it that way, just don't want to pay attention to. And that really defines this difference, is to look at the whole process rather than to look at this one part that you're influencing right now, rather than thinking about its influence over the entire system.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You encapsulated it really well. These companies that, you know, I chose to feature in the book have really thought about their business in a very holistic sense. It's not just like we're going to make clothes out of recycled plastic bottles and that's our environmental impact on the world. It's really also about how they run their businesses, how their supply chains operate. I can give you the example of Veja, which is a footwear company in the book. You know, so they are a shoe brand, and they've thought about every aspect of the shoe being manufactured in Brazil so that they could keep it within one country instead of having products and materials being sourced from all over the world, which is typically what happens in apparel and in footwear. You've got pieces and parts all over. And then, you know, even within that, they've thought about, okay, we're going to get the organic cotton from the northern part of Brazil here. We're going to get the rubber from the Amazon, working with the rubber tappers in a very sustainable way. And then we're going to manufacture it in a factory that's in on the border of Uruguay and Brazil. So all of it is happening within one country. And while that seems, you know, almost very basic, it is different. It's very much different to the way manufacturing happens compared to other brands.
That touches on the idea that a lot of circular economy events will be primarily regional rather than global, but then there's the interconnection between all these regional circular economies that we'll be looking at. And we'll talk a little more about that later. But let me ask you this, is everyone getting involved in these changes, or are you seeing this primarily being driven by younger people?
You know, I think that's an interesting question. So I've been writing about this space for about 10 plus years now, mm-hmm. and I've really seen it grow and flourish, I would say, in the last 5-6 years. I don't think it's just on the fringes anymore. And yes, while Gen Z and a lot of, you know, younger folks under 30 are really, I think, very passionate about environmental change, and rightly so, I see this happening across industries, which is why in the book we've, you know, showcased so many different industries as well, across the world, across, you know, different demographics. I don't see this being a niche. I mean, I can't remember 7-8 years ago if every company had a director of sustainability, but now it seems very much so the norm. That means that there has been a shift. There's an understanding when you have even big, you know, companies, if you look at the agricultural space, when you have a Cargill or a General Mills talking about regenerative agriculture, you know, these concepts are going mainstream. Now, whether or not they're going to do it truthfully and actually have the kind of impact we hope for, that's a whole other conversation. But no, I definitely think that we're getting more and more closer to mainstream. The concern now is more so, you know, the greenwashing that may be happening, mm-hmm. or how mm-hmm. much of this is genuine. But I don't think that this is something that's being driven by just one small sector of society.
Well, do you see this as then, you know, because we do tend to talk about like the sustainability sector, but really it becomes an integral part of every business process across the economy if this works out the way it seems you're describing. What would happen if we don't accomplish that transition? Does business have a future?
I think we're at the point now where I feel like most major industries realize that this is not just important from a marketing or consumer, you know, approach, but it's really important for their success and for their resilience and their ability to even have some of these supply chains 10, 20 years down the road. You know, we're talking a lot more about resiliency and supply chain. And what does that mean? That means that if you are sourcing an agricultural product and it is dealing with the environmental impacts today from climate change, how is that product or how is that crop going to be there 10 years from now, 15 years from now? And that means you have to invest in it, which is why you're seeing a lot of big food brands or in apparel with cotton, major apparel brands really looking at their supply chains closely and realizing this is not necessarily something they can take for granted. So, I mean, yes, absolutely. I think it needs to be a core part of business and people are looking at it that way.
Now, one of the most important factors in the story you talk about is finance. And many of the companies that you describe bootstrapped themselves or they grew on government grants, but then large scale growth, getting to really major scale requires a lot of money. Do you see investors, and did you talk to investors like private equity offices or family offices that are driving this transition globally?
Absolutely. So there's two schools of thought in this. There are companies that have steered clear of investors primarily because they do not want to deal with the pressures that come with having an investor. That means you have another voice you have to listen to. It means perhaps you have to be really focused on maximizing profits faster than you would like to. It could mean less experimentation in some cases. So that's why you've seen some companies that are mentioned in the book. They've either bootstrapped it or they've, you know, had access to funding from a previous venture that they've rolled into a new one. But there are companies in the book that have taken on investors, absolutely. And there's a whole chapter on finance that looks at impact investing, which is a space that has grown rapidly again in the last 10 years. And there are countless investors out there that are interested in supporting these kinds of businesses. You know, whenever you take on an investor, it's like getting into a marriage, right? So whether it's an impact investor or it's a traditional investor, you have to figure out if that's the right person for that company. And I think that holds true even in this space. Any entrepreneur that you talk to in the sustainability space will feel the same way. You have to, even if it's an impact investor, you have to really think about the long-term relationship you're going to have with this organization. And with impact investors also, there's good apples and there's some not so good apples. And with impact investors, there is an understanding that this is a long-term game. You're not looking at something that's necessarily going to give you return in 3, 5 years, maybe even 7 years. You could be looking at 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple investors that are mentioned in the finance chapter. There's Grey Ghost Ventures, which is based out of Atlanta in the US. There's Triodos, which is very well known in this space, which is based out of the Netherlands. And these are all investors who really understood that, okay, if we're going to get behind a company that's doing something risky, new, innovative, different, it's going to take time to show profit. And that's the most important thing, that they have to have the patience to be able to go on that journey with the entrepreneur. But I agree with you. I mean, I think there's cases where businesses don't need funding, and then there's cases where businesses really do need the funding to be able to scale. The narrative that I kept hearing over and over again from these entrepreneurs was that we're just tired of being in the rat race focused on just returns, which is what they were seeing in sort of like the conventional system. And that's what we're trying to shift away from. You know, is it like, can we have a thought about how scale works? Because that's the other problem. Like many people, the first question they'll say is, okay, so how do you scale this, right? But is scale always the answer? I mean,
a great question.
Yeah. I mean, do you need to be an international brand or even a national brand in every case? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Actually, the founder of Veja, Sebastian, he said something that was very thoughtful where, you know, he said, maybe the answer is we have lots of small to medium-sized companies, and that's more so the model that we need to approach. It's not necessarily that we need to have these large scale operations everywhere in the world in every industry. So it's also taking that into account and having that shift in your mindset. I think that's really critical to think about when you're looking at business and scale.
It's interesting. You brought up marriage as a metaphor, mm-hmm. and actually bringing an investor in is not so much like monogamy, but polygamy.
Yeah.
Yeah, which makes it all the more complicated. But family is another way to think about this new model. The smaller businesses too is an example of that. A collection of family businesses keeps more money in the local economy, which creates greater equity. And that's the other end of the of this calculus that we're trying to figure out right now is how do we get a better outcome for everyone?
Absolutely. And there's certain industries where that really makes sense. So, for example, in the travel chapter, I showcase a small hotel that is in Orland Valley in Norway, which is very close to a small village or town, you could say, Flåm, which is at the gateway of the fjords. This is an area that tourists flock to. You're talking millions of tourists are descending on these small, small villages in Norway to see the fjords. And the couple that started this boutique hotel, you know, they have no ambitions to turn this into a franchise or, you know, scale it up. The beauty of it is that it is small. They want to keep it that way to preserve the local environment, to preserve the local culture. And they're trying to get people to appreciate, you know, where they're from and their roots and the culture and the heritage of their particular property. So there's countless places where you find that actually small is plenty. All we have to do is we have to replicate small, and then you have the same effect. So go ahead.
I was going to say Flåm is a really interesting story because it's a village of 300 people that when a ship docks suddenly becomes 100 times larger. And you describe pollution in this small town at the edge of the Arctic Circle that is as bad as some major cities. And the hotel you're talking about, the Vikes Hotel, what's their aesthetic? How did they get people to visit without leaving such a heavy footprint?
So the thing with Flåm is like it's like many other tourist destinations, right? Because it's such a beautiful place of natural beauty. So everybody wants to go there. So when you go there, there's about, I mean, I can't remember exactly now, it's been many years, but maybe 5 or 6 hotels that are really the prime hotels that are there on the edge of the fjord that you can stay in. And everybody goes there because the cruises come dock there. So if you're going to spend the night, you could stay there in the hotel, or you could, you know, take the bus, which is what I did from town, and come out there and stay there. And while it's lovely, it's very touristy. It is dealing with these massive cruises that come park themselves every morning or every other morning there. So they kill the view, they kill the vibe completely. And as I talked to the founder of 29 Orland, this boutique hotel that's in the same valley, just about a 10-15 minute drive away, she was actually a reporter and a journalist who lived in Oslo and was seeking a different lifestyle. So her and her husband moved out to Orland and they started up this operation. And she said, you know, you can visit the fjord in smaller boats. You can visit the fjord by going on hikes. You can visit the fjord in so many different ways. You don't have to come in on a massive cruise. So that's the experience that they're giving their guests. It's very well connected. You can certainly still get to their hotel. It's about the same price point. It's not even like that. It's egregiously more expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's made very thoughtfully using locally sourced materials with the local aesthetic. And they organize all these things that you can do. So, you know, she herself, the owner, will take you out on a hike on a waterfall. They'll arrange a visit to the nearby village so you can meet the local baker or the local cheesemonger. You can go down to the fjord and row in a boat. You can go on a picnic. And it's really this, you know, approach of slow travel also. If you're going to come to a place like Norway and visit the fjords, you don't need to be in a hurry and sort of like checking off the checklist, right? So come enjoy 4 or 5 days then, really absorb that environment. I think that's part of the challenge is you have to change your mindset. I mean, I've changed my mindset when it comes to travel. Mm-hmm. I find that if you're going to go somewhere, really settle down, relax, absorb yourself in those surroundings. And you don't need to like tick off this list that tourists tend to have of visiting all the sites, right?
It's a different form of travel that you're describing.
Absolutely. And so I think that that's part of it also. And the travel chapter looks at that. It's not just about going to a property that meets all the eco requirements. That's fantastic from an operational standpoint. But it's also like how we as individuals choose to travel because that has a footprint, you know, rather than taking a cruise ship all around 10 different places. You know, can you just go to one place and nestle down there for a few days and enjoy that vibe?
You know, I want to talk more about tourism, but we're going to take a quick commercial break and we're going to be right back.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let's get back to the conversation with Esha Chhabra. She is the author of Working to Restore, Harnessing the Power of Regenerative Business to Heal the World. So, Esha, the tourism is a thing that came up for me both as a point of anxiety and opportunity throughout the book. It accounts, according to the UN, for about 1 in 10 jobs around the world, and it certainly plays a big role in your narrative, both as an industry in transition and the source of revenue for people in the global south. So this is what I was thinking. Is do you see evidence that there are low-impact travel options available or emerging that will help people continue to move around the planet as tourists with a substantially lower environmental impact?
Yes, absolutely. And I think about this even with my own work. I mean, for this particular book, it required me to go to these places and meet with many of these folks. And so I was very conscious of it myself. I wouldn't necessarily want to travel to the extent that I had to for this book, you know, every day or regularly, and I wouldn't recommend it. It's perhaps not even good for your sanity. But I think the approach to travel that I've personally taken, and I feel like, you know, many people in this space sort of take the similar approaches. Mm-hmm. You can certainly take an economy seat on a plane and fly. You know, you don't need to feel a guilt trip every single time you sit on a plane. What you need to think about is how long are you going for? Mm-hmm. And is that the most efficient route that you're taking? So if you're a tourist, you have the option of being able to set up your own itinerary. Where I think it's even more of a headache, honestly, is with business travel. Because tourists can be very thoughtful. They can say, okay, I'm going to go to this one destination. And if your, you know, vacation time allows for it, please go there for, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, and really enjoy that one place. That's really, I feel like, where we're compounding our emissions and our impact is when we're constantly sort of bopping around from place to place to place, and we're not really spending enough time in one place, because then you're just adding on more logistics and more emissions. So I've done this now personally, where I try to go somewhere and I spend an extended period of time there. So mm-hmm. you're really only taking one long haul flight then, hopefully. And then, yes, there's an abundance of options. I mean, when I was doing this book also, for example, if I had to rent a car, I requested a hybrid if I could. I took loads of trains. I mean, I've taken trains in all different types of countries now. They're fine, you know, even if they're not the most amenity rich, you could say, in certain places, you'll get around just fine. And they're a great way to meet people. They're a great way to see the countryside. I actually prefer them to flying if I can. So yes, it's not necessarily like, I don't think the message needs to be don't travel at all. But no, and that is anxiety inducing. I see that on social media and I'm like, no, yeah. That's not the answer. The answer is be more thoughtful with your travel. I think one of the great things with the pandemic, and I hope this sustains itself, is that the business community finally woke up to the reality that you do not need to fly for one day events all year round. You know, I mean, that's really what's causing the problem. If you can really reduce that kind of travel, I think we'll have a much broader impact. And in terms of the tourism options, there's so many lovely businesses and hotels that are now cropping up all over the world. If you just take time to do some research, whether it's on Airbnb or TripAdvisor or Booking.com, any of those places, you will find businesses that have social impact or environmental impact embedded into them. I mean, I remember landing up in Nairobi to do a story that's in the book. And I ended up staying in a hotel that was like a social enterprise that was run by young people there who were trying to learn a career in hospitality. And all the money from, you know, the guests went back into running the social enterprise and training these young people. And it was a very modest hotel, affordable for anyone to stay in. So if you just dig around, you can certainly find places that you can support when you're traveling that also do have some kind of good mission aligned with them.
Well, you're reiterating what you were saying before, is that it's about a different kind of travel. It's not, I'm going to check off all the places I've been, but that you are actually going to be like a journalist in a sense, a witness to a place and its lifeways for a few days or for a few weeks. And that does, relatively speaking, justify the trip. You know, I have this same challenge. I have a daughter who is moving to Europe, so I am going to be going to Europe, but I'm not going to go for a day. I'm going to go for a month at a time. And we can be responsible in our travel and contribute to this greater equity worldwide. And that's the other side of the conversation, is that throughout the book, you emphasize just wages, just compensation. One of the elements of that is you envision a kind of a new layer of middle people who are certifying, for instance, like you were saying, that a hotel is sustainable, or that coffee is sustainably grown, harvested, and that it reflects fair trade practices. People got paid well. How does business think about communicating that to its potential customers all over the world as they're trying to bring business to these regions?
So that's actually a very complicated question. I'll try to tackle it. Because there's a couple of things going on here. So in the book, yes, we look at coffee, we look at cocoa, we look at, you know, a lot of different food products and agricultural supply chains. There's two thoughts to this. One is, actually, most of the companies that you speak to, they're a little frustrated with the certifications, to be honest, because there's too many of them now, and they're too complicated to explain to consumers. I don't think most consumers, unless you live in this world of, you know, sustainability or are very eco-minded, I don't think they're aware of what each certification stands for. And there's costs that come with them for businesses. I mean, that's the other challenge, is that every certification that you decide to do, there's an added cost involved. And it can be actually burdensome for some businesses. I mean, smaller businesses, even some medium-sized businesses, have started to stray away from the certifications because they don't feel like the costs justify it. I think what we need is greater transparency. That several of these companies talk about. So whether it's like Veja, which I mentioned earlier, the footwear brand, like, for example, they don't use the word sustainability. They really focus on transparency. And they have posted on their website how much they're buying the cotton from, the amount that they've bought. You can see the receipts for it, the accounts for it for the particular year. Or you look at Falcon Coffee, which is another example in the book, which is technically a middleman in the coffee world. So they are an exporter out of, importer-exporter out of the UK. And they basically help roasters, you know, get their coffee beans. So once a farmer is done producing, you know, their coffee, it's handed off to a local tradesperson who then will find somebody who will internationally export it to whatever destination it needs to go to. And there's so many hands involved in that process. And so the question then happens is, like, does the farmer really get what they're worth? That's where typically fair trade and other certifications have come in to say, if the commodity price for coffee is $1 a pound, we're going to say it needs to be $1.30 a pound or $1.20 a pound to give an extra premium to those farmers. And most folks will say that's a good start, but it's not enough. We need to probably pay them more. And we probably need greater transparency in the supply chain. And we need to have fewer people in the supply chain kind of eating away at every layer of that profit. So what Falcon has done, and what the founder Conrad Britz has really advocated for over the years, is something called a collaborative supply chain. He's like, you know, how do we work together and give respect to the people that are actually growing our food? And that means reducing the number of hands that exchange it, but also creating some transparency. And so he's created transparency for his clients so that they can see exactly how much the prices are at each stage. I think that this is probably one of the hardest things, honestly, to solve in the book, aside from possibly renewable energy, it's a very complex web. And once you start to learn about global supply chains, you realize they take a long time. They're hard to change. It's not an easy system that you can change because it's so rooted and embedded in different cultures. And there has to be an appetite for it. You know, you need somebody visionary at the helm who's willing to say, okay, we're going to do things a little differently. So yeah, I think this is honestly one of the most challenging aspects of business right now.
Well, we talk a lot about disruption in technology industries, for instance, but this is what we're describing here. And this is clear throughout the book that we're going to disintermediate one set of middlemen who basically were value neutral. They just bought and sold without regard for any of the implications, and replacing them with middlemen who have responsibility to provide that transparency, to ensure that the wages are fair. That's a different set of relationships, and certainly something that, to your point about what consumers currently think about, it's a challenge to change your mindset about how you shop. Have you thought about how, for instance, Falcon Coffee succeeded in communicating the values that it represents?
I think with Falcon, if we use Falcon as an example, you have someone at the head of that business who's a great communicator. Conrad is a very thoughtful communicator. I think that really helps when he's interacting with his clients and he's able to explain these concepts. I think the way that they've positioned themselves by also working with other people who are committed to these values, that's part of the challenge in this space, honestly, is finding people in the business community who are willing to be on the same wavelength as you, or at least try to be on the same wavelength as you. So if you go to a major coffee brand and you tell them that you have all these wonderful attributes to your company, and they don't, frankly, you know, value that, it's going to be a hard sell no matter what. Yeah. So you have to find folks who are willing to kind of go on this journey with you. But I think with Falcon, you know, they've done a really good job at just kind of focusing on the few essential points that are important in the coffee supply chain and really tackling those. And I think the work has also spoken for themselves. They have, for example, taken on impact investors, and, you know, they've taken on all these risks where they've put in loans for some of their coffee suppliers who couldn't get loans because, you know, the challenge oftentimes is financing in agriculture. Mm-hmm. If your cotton supplier or coffee supplier cannot get the funding that they need for that particular harvest, are they going to look after their crop as thoughtfully? Are they going to be as vested in the supply chain? Perhaps not. So to be able to come in and say, okay, we're going to take on that risk. We're going to put our money where our mouth is, and we're going to help you succeed. That shows that you believe in these values. And I think then on the other side, people understand that you're serious about this. This is not something you're just doing because it sounds good.
I hear echoes of the commitment that you represent, that is represented by forming a family and thinking about how we collectively, humans around the world, have different kinds of relationships is really critical to the way that the people you describe in the book do business.
Yes. Not one single entity is going to be able to take on these issues and solve them. And so it is definitely a collective effort. And every, you know, whether it's the consumer, whether it's the supplier, whether it's the, you know, retailer, whomever, they all have a role to play in this. Absolutely. And I think sometimes what happens in this space, I see that is like the onus is put on just one party. You know, it's like, no, the consumer just needs to change the way that they shop. No, I don't think that it's just that. Like, for example, if we go back to travel, you know, people get very nervous about air travel because they think about the carbon emissions. Really, you know, honestly, if aviation changes in the near future, and it is trying to, I mean, they're doing the R&D that's required to change the fuel sources. That's where you're going to see the really fast impact. I mean, if we are able to find another alternative source that's just as good as fossil fuel to use for aviation, all of a sudden flights will become, you know, less harmful for the environment. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a holistic approach.
Well, Esha, it's been great talking with you about the book, and I hope people take time to read it. How can everyone follow along with what you're writing now?
So I've been writing on Forbes lately quite a bit, so you can certainly find me there. And I try to highlight up and coming companies so you can get some new ideas that are happening in the sustainability space. And I have my website, which is eshacharbra.com. So you're welcome to check that out, which has got all the latest details.
Great. Well, thank you for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mitch.
We've been speaking with Esha Chhabra. She is the author of Working to Restore, Harnessing the Power of Regenerative Business to Heal the World. And you can learn more about her at eshachhabra.com. That's one word, no space, no dash. Esha is spelled E-S-H-A, Chhabra, C-H-H-A-B-R-A, eshachhabra.com. And many of our articles are collected at eshachhabra.contently.com. You know, business became a sterile practice when it decided in the 1950s and 60s to insulate itself from the externalities that its operations produce. For example, the environmental and social cost of pollution. Now we hear every day about companies' struggles to win customers and retain employees because they do not address those same externalities. The bill for impersonal, profit-centric capitalism is coming due, and the transformation of the economy is changing the very nature of business. Esha's observations about the circular, familial approach to building sustainable businesses are reports from the bleeding edge of innovation that will bubble up from the bottom to create a low-carbon, sustainable economy. We may not reach net zero emissions, but we can keep humanity's annual carbon emissions and environmental impact well within the Earth's ability to support us. Esha's book, Working to Restore, will be available on Amazon and at bookstores this month, and we'll include links to buy it with this episode of Sustainability in Your Ear. And you can help by sharing this podcast or one of the more than 380 other interviews on Sustainability in Your Ear. If you take a minute to share a podcast and write a review, it will really make a difference for us. You folks are the amplifiers that can spread more ideas to create less waste. Tell your friends and family, your coworkers, people on the street. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, or any of the other fine purveyors of podcast goodness you may choose to support. Thank you for listening. I'm Mitch Ratcliffe. This is Earth 911, and we'll be back with another innovator interview soon. In the meantime, folks, take care of yourself, take care of one another, and let's all take care of this beautiful planet of ours. Have a green day.